Axel Merk, founder, CEO, and CIO of Merk Investments. Thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
Axel, I want to start by kind of getting your feeling. Obviously, you run a very specific gold miner fund. Do you think that we are in a position at this point still where gold miners are a bargain, or are they fairly priced?
The higher price we've seen in precious metals is not fully reflected in the miners. In that sense, they are a quote-unquote bargain. Now, that said, I have to weigh that, my speech is regulated, with the with the obvious statement that they've had an amazing run, right? And if anything anybody knows in the sector is that volatility can be very substantial. But if when I look at the miners, there are different types of investors in this space, right? And we see that the generalist investor is getting more interested, especially in the majors. We're talking here in the middle of January, and the majors, at least in recent days, have kind of outperformed the juniors a little bit. When we've heard from mining executives of mid-sized companies that they have generalist investors of large fund companies attending the meeting, so they're trying to get to know the space, and so it's moving more in that direction where a broader range is interested. And then obviously the one investor that's jumped on board or back on board is the speculator. Those old enough with enough gray hairs I do, or as little hairs you do, remember that speculators used to be rampant in this mining space, and they kind of then disappeared because there was more exciting to be in meme stocks and crypto SPACs, and then those are starting to come back. But especially when we look at, we are heavily invested on the early producers that were recently starts developers, we think there's tremendous value. Now, I say that presumably with a biased opinion, but I think key is, and I don't want to rant on forever here, is that investors maybe have been burned too many times, because when the price of gold rises, you don't historically have had the sort of leverage to the bottom line, because commodity prices being a major driver, for example, used to skyrocket. 20-25% of the cost of mining is that, and commodity prices are low, right? And cost of labor tends to skyrocket in a broad commodity boom. And yes, labor markets are tight in that sector, but by far not as tight as in previous sectors. Governments historically want to get higher taxes when profitability is high, and we've seen a little of that, but not much of it. And so a lot of that profitability goes to the bottom line, and I don't think that's properly reflected in the valuations of these companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it seems like the margin expansion is better than ever in a lot of these gold miners. But do you think that becomes one of the factors that draws more capital, more eyeballs into this space?
Well, it clearly draws more capital. The funding window is wide open right now. It is easy to finance projects, or easier. And the question is, of course, how long that will last. And I don't think anybody knows. It can last a month. It can last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So capital is more willing to finance projects, and which also means, of course, that some projects will be financed that are not as good. I may want to remind people, in 2022, in the higher for longer environment, the valuations were depressed because access to financing was difficult, and the best projects had access to financing at reduced valuations. It allowed us to reposition from explorers to developers, because they were just such bargains, such tremendous bargains in our assessment. And that's repositioning has been paying off handsomely. And so the environment is evolving. The question is really, in what inning are we? How late are we in the stage? I do think there is still a very healthy two-way market, especially also on the physical side. One thing I like to mention is that the wholesalers that get coins from the mints to sell to the coin dealers, their business is not doing so great. And the reason is because a lot of retail folks are selling their coins to the dealers, and so the dealers have plenty of inventory. To me, that's not a hallmark of a market peak, right? But hey, I don't know what the market is going to do tomorrow. I'm just observing here.
Well, do you think that there's a big juxtaposition between the market condition that you just mentioned of plenty of inventory on in coin dealer within coin dealers versus the wholesale side? Is there a big difference between, let's say, the West versus the East in that regard, or do you know?
Well, I mean, as we are talking, right, silver and Shanghai are trading over $90 an ounce. And so there is clearly a difference here. The silver buyer on the industrial side is not as price sensitive. And so they're apparently willing to pay up. And so there's clearly a difference in these markets. And I mean, to your point, the one thing I think investors often don't appreciate is we're dealing in physical markets with real logistical constraints, and so it matters where there is demand. And when we talk about the price of gold, it's the price of gold of a London bar in London for an ounce, anyway. And so if you need that gold somewhere else, and we noticed that, of course, when we had the flight of precious metals out of London into COMEX earlier this year, and then people were scrambling back, there are real logistical challenges. And the one other thing I like to remind people is with gold, you have in an ounce over $4,000 worth of value. In silver, even with this appreciation, you got 80. Close to $90 an ounce, which means you need a hell of a lot of silver for significant value. Another way of saying this is the vaults don't like silver. They have to do real work to move that stuff around. It's huge, huge volume that need to ship around to get to real values. And so when one is looking at potential dislocations in the markets, those physical characteristics may well factor into that.
Well, Axel, you know, you bring up an interesting point about this, you know, just the difference between moving silver versus gold around in a vault or for these dealers. Do you think that there's, let's say, a bigger difference in what is driving silver at this moment versus what's driving gold? Like, are they on different trajectories because of different factors?
Well, they've always been different. The silver has the industrial use, and because of that is notoriously volatile. It benefits from monetary easing, but often that happens in conjunction with an economic slowdown. So silver is always a bit schizophrenic. It doesn't quite know whether it wants to skyrocket or to plunge. Any precious metals investor has been frustrated over the years, and silver investor is just asking to be frustrated, right? It feels great on the way up, but then on the way down, it doesn't feel so good. And so the one thing I'd just like to tell people is when you invest in these, just be aware that this volatility can skyrocket and it's not a one-way street. And so you've got to be able to stomach that. And gold in particular has a volatility in the long run that's about the same as the equity markets, the S&P, but then has these periods where it can really move higher. And again, it feels great on the way up, but as a portfolio manager, as an asset manager, I think in terms of risk much more than in terms of price. And so you've got to be able to think about the risk that you can handle in your own portfolio.
Mm. Well, of course, you know, gold is notoriously a lower volatility asset. But in the last 12 months, we've seen it appreciate the price nearly 75%, right? And that's historically a very volatile period for gold. What do you see as the factors that are either coming or already present that continue to propel gold higher from here?
So I don't want to repeat everything that presumably all the other guests have said already. Let me just try to touch on it. Let me touch on one that investors that you may not hear as much. I don't remember whether I've mentioned it when I've talked to you before. The one area I like to maybe zoom in on that you don't hear from everybody else is that when you have tariffs, You're not just impeding the flow of goods, you're impeding the flow of currency, the other side of that trade. And that means that you're throwing sand into the machinery that we call exorbitant privilege. The US is really a, you can think of the US as a giant hedge fund, a giant bank where you borrow cheap in the US for higher returns abroad. And I'm not saying that that machinery is dead, but it's being disrupted with tariffs. And as less currency is flowing back into the US, borrowing costs are moving higher in the US. And so the proper way to fix that is you reduce deficits. Well, anybody who's less than I don't know, 100 years old, probably knows that Congress doesn't have so many incentives to reduce deficits. And so instead, what we have seen is increased pressure on the Federal Reserve and to keep rates low. And so that is, I'm phrasing it positively, good for the price of gold. But because you're putting pressure on rates and ultimately, gold competes with the real value of a currency. And we used to look, or still look at it, the long-term real yields. Now, I tend to lose an audience when I talk about the 10-year TIPS yield and the like, and people tell me there is no way anybody knows what inflation will be in 10 years from now. And that's absolutely correct. But there are market measures of these, and they are really measures of confidence in the central banks, Federal Reserves in our case, ability to manage inflation in the long run. And relative changes in those perceptions matter. And so there is, so that is a key driver. The other driver is the weaponization of the dollar that started several years ago. If you are not positively inclined versus the US, you have a quote unquote incentive to diversify your treasury holdings. And if anything, that has accelerated. It doesn't mean that foreign central banks put all their money into gold, but gold is a beneficiary of that trend, right? And then the other part of it is that we have more activist politicians, not just in the US. China's always had it. Europeans have it as well. When the Europeans spend over $1 trillion, Germany alone, a fortune on both infrastructure and defense, I joke that you're getting the best economic recovery debt can buy. But what it also is, and also these attempts in the US to support certain industries, and there may be good national security reasons for it, don't get me wrong on that, but there are unintended consequences, and most notably that capital is deployed less efficiently. When government deploys capital, it is less efficient than when the private sector does it. The cost of doing business is going up. And so, which means you need to spend more money to achieve the same sort of thing that you'd otherwise do. So those are all factors that ultimately are supportive for the price of gold. And then last but not least is the obvious one. We are in a somewhat of an easing environment, which is historically a sweet spot for precious metals.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the point that gold seems to be really showing, let's say, the depreciation of the fiat currency. And I saw a tweet this morning here. It said, these are all record highs: stocks, gold, silver, home prices, copper, platinum, money market funds, US debt, deficit spending, and household debt. When everything hits a record high at the same time, it's not a coincidence. Fiat currencies are depreciating. And you know, I don't know that we need to really analyze it that much further, other than trying to understand the current situation that we're in from that perspective, right?
Well, what's special and very frustrating, I might add, is that historically, when gold is high, other assets don't perform so well. And as somebody who has been a gold investor actively since the early 2000s, and by the way, for those who don't know us, we manage about just under $4 billion now in gold and gold miners, up, by the way, from 1.6 or 1.7 billion, a little over a year ago, to give you an idea of how this space has evolved. But what's frustrating is in 2008 and 9, I could go and buy a car and negotiate at the dealer because economy was doing poorly. We were doing well in 2008, and so I had additional purchasing power. Whereas now, we have been doing well. Presumably, most other precious metals investors have been doing well. And when we negotiate, and when we want to splurge for a special item, you have much less leverage because, quote unquote, everything is going up. We've got this K-shaped economy where the wealthy are doing just fine. And so that is different. And yes, it is in the sense that, quote unquote, everything has gone up. The question is, of course, how that will play out in the medium term, because at some point there might be a revaluation of other assets. Will gold hold up in that environment or not? And the one thing, and of course, we have no idea how long this pricing boom will last. I like to remind people that Greenspan warned about irrational exuberance in late 96, and it lasted in the early 2000s. The key difference to the late 90s is that a lot of the infrastructure spending, notably on data centers and the like, is debt driven. And that is very different from the boom we had in the late 90s, where it was very much equity driven. And so socializing the losses, so to speak, in after dot-com bust was not a systemic issue because, your equity portfolio went down. Whereas the question is, if there's a lot of debt that's financed a lot of these things, is there a role for the central banks to cut rates aggressively to buffer the bust, so to speak, right? And if that is the scenario, precious metals should do just fine. I mean, you just talked about it, right? The decline of fiat currencies. Well, that's been happening for 100 years, right? It doesn't mean precious metals go up every day. And so you can have a decline of fiat currencies, and have an extended bear market that we had in precious metals for almost a decade, right? And so I'm just trying to caution here that even though I presumably many people listening believe that, yeah, fiat currencies may be doomed, policymakers are fabulous can kickers. They can push the day of reckoning down the road. And so I just always try to be humble in kind of seeing what's coming next. And so when there's too much leverage or too much speculation in an area, we might see a correction. And in that sense, volatility is good, right? When volatility spikes, it's a disincentive to use leverage. It shakes out the weak hands. And so we need those periodic episodes of volatility, also on the downside, to for a sustained bull market to continue.
Well, I think that's a great way to put it, is that policymakers can be fabulous can kickers. I mean, I don't know that anybody realistically would have looked at the situation over the last decade and thought that we would still be at this point a decade later.
And by the
But
way,
I
to
don't.
just add to that, the policymakers can also change the rules of the game, right? We saw that in 2008, when push comes to shove, they'll do, quote unquote, whatever it takes, which means you might be perfectly right on the analysis and you might still lose your shirt because suddenly the government comes up with some rule change where you were betting your money on just didn't work out.
So, do you have any idea as to what some of those crazy pull out all the stops situations could be?
Well, I mean, the classic ones are price controls, right? That sort of thing. You can have you can have expropriation. You can have a mandate to do certain things. I mean, if you think about it, if you have strategic minerals, right? They're crucial. So the government might say, yep, it's government ownership. I mean, the government is investing in these companies. So maybe they want to have a seat at the table and direct policy of what's going to happen. The silver, Elon Musk talked about, hey, he needs silver for as a commodity. So maybe you're not allowed to hoard it as a speculator. I mean, you never quite know what's going to happen. The nice thing about gold is it has fairly little industrial use, so it's less prone to these things. Bessent, Treasury Secretary, is a self-prescribed gold bug, and when there was a talk about tariffs on gold, he said, no, it's not going to happen. But there is, who knows what's going to happen, right? It's a the way to manage that risk, if you can manage it at all, is to be careful with leverage. It's called diversification, right? So you don't have all your eggs in one nest, but all and you can try to think about what might happen. I think again on the gold side, I'm less concerned because unlike what many conspiracy theorists think, I don't think the government has its focus on gold, even though gold has been declared a strategic mineral as well, right? And the idea for that was, of course, to there was in the general push to reduce red tape if you have a mine on federal property to try to speed up the approval processes.
Well, it's interesting. The name of the Fed chair is escaping me right now, but he said, in that time, they feel like they should have done more to control the price of gold. I think it was Greenspan or somewhere in that era. So, they obviously do pay attention to it, but as you said, like maybe not to the extent that we think it's an outright deliberate action to
If I
control that.
can disagree, you say obviously, I don't think they pay attention to it. I engage policymakers actively when I can. I attend conferences that are mostly attended by academics, where sitting the Fed governors and presidents are sometimes present. So I get to talk to them, I get to hear them. They'll have a comment on precious metals if they're asked, but no, it is not on their mind for the most part. They don't really
Interesting.
they care about their I call it the debating club, the FOMC. They care about the minutiae of their data. They may not be focusing on some of the proper things, right? And they may not be doing the right analysis of what got them all to be astray to cause inflation several times over. But no, I don't think that precious metals are top of mind.
Sure. You bring up the FOMC, and obviously we've seen not necessarily directly Trump attack Powell as very recently here, but there's this criminal indictment against the Federal Reserve seemingly because they're not willing to play ball with the way that Trump wants to th see things happen and to see rates where they are. Do you think that Fed independence is of utmost importance going forward, even past the end of Powell's term and past Trump's term as well?
So just to clarify, there is no indictment at this stage. The Powell spoke up on Sunday, making public that he received notice that there might be one, but it has not happened. And so I think it's an important distinction. To maybe upset your entire audience, Fed independence is of utmost importance. Let me just expand on that and explain that. First of all, if anybody says, oh, we should get rid of the Fed and have a gold standard, I'm with you, right? But you can only have a gold standard if your finances are sustainable, when you have fiscal sustainability, when you have running excessive deficits, you cannot have a gold standard. And so the world we live in is one where we do have central banks. And there is this tension between government and how they finance themselves, right? We have a system where we have a credit-driven society. Credit-driven societies have shown to have more economic growth. And it's not just individuals and consumers, it's also governments that want to finance themselves. When the Federal Reserve was created, they created this entity that can create money out of thin air. And so it's like having a cookie jar sitting there for Congress to or the president to get its fingers on. And the question is whether that is a good idea that they can tap into that cookie jar, because if history is any guide, where central banks have lost their independence, there will be an assault on that cookie jar. That means governments will spend recklessly. It's the end of price stability and inflation. And I mentioned earlier this arcane metric of TIPS yields, long-term inflation yields. By the way, those have not moved meaningfully. And so even though Powell has spoken up, it is not that the market has said, oh my God, we now live in a banana republic. The market continues to have confidence in what the Fed does. And by the way, as a practical matter, Powell's term is up in May, right? Any process that might happen is going to take longer than that. So it is all very theoretical. But there's a reason why not just Powell has spoken up, but you had all the living Fed chairs, including Greenspan, we just mentioned, Yellen, Bernanke, speak up. You had some former Treasury secretaries, including Tim Geithner, and others speak up. You had folks from the left and the right speak up. And then we had this this statement from foreign central banks that are very cautious in intervening in anything domestic in the US. And it's because the US isn't just the anchor of the risk-free rate in the US, they're the anchor of the risk-free rate globally in many ways. And so that independence is cherished. Now, let me take the other side of that just for a moment. Why we have come here. In order for a central bank to pursue its, and by the way, of course, those who say they haven't delivered price stability, 2% inflation is not price stability. That's all correct, right? There's plenty I have to criticize about the Fed. I have criticized Powell for not having a more of a reaction function, meaning being more quantitative or doing things off the cuff, for not doing a proper review of the great inflation we've had. All that criticism is warranted, but giving up independence is not the right choice, the right answer. Now, the Fed has, to a significant extent, itself to blame for what's been coming. It is not Trump. I mean, Trump obviously is his own persona that does things in his own way, but when the Federal Reserve veers away from monetary policy, steps onto fiscal turf, there is no surprise that the fiscal side or the executive is pushing back and is taking interest. And let me first maybe explain what the difference is. Monetary policy is supposed to be and is about setting interest rates. It's about money supply. It's about the available credit in the economy. Fiscal policy is about allocating credit to a specific sector of the economy. It's a political choice. You have taxation and regulation that does it. And so in 2008, when the Federal Reserve ramped up its buying of mortgage-backed securities to buy mortgage-backed securities, that is a political decision. That is nothing that the Federal Reserve should be doing. And I'm a purist in that sense. Because many others think it's okay. I don't think it's okay for the Fed to be engaged in the mortgage business. Similarly, of course, in the pandemic, the Federal Reserve allocated credit directly to businesses. That is absolutely unacceptable. And then, of course, Powell has talked about, and it's this part of all the DEI thing, how they want to help this constituent, that constituent. The Federal Reserve can't do that, and they must not do that. You have elected officials to that. And I just mentioned I'm not a fan of the Fed buying mortgage-backed securities, and many of your audience may recall that Trump decided that, hey, Fannie and Freddie should be using its cash to buy mortgage-backed securities. Now, you can argue about the wisdom of that because it doesn't increase supply, but it's a political decision with political accountability. It is absolutely in the purview of the executive to do that, right? I can criticize it if I don't like it, but it is separate from the Federal Reserve doing this sort of stuff. And so when the Federal Reserve is increasingly, or take the bailout after interest rate mismanagement in the banking system after Silicon Valley's blow up, you are really doing things that go beyond its mandate. And it's in that context, Powell has stood over some of this thing. I call him a lame duck long before any of this has happened. There is time for change at the helm. Of the three candidates, there is one person who's actually been advocating for over a decade to fix some of these things. That's the sort of change we need to get back to basics. But getting rid of quote unquote independence is a terrible, terrible idea.
Axel, if we continue down that road and we lose Fed independence, what do you think that ends up looking like? Do you think Trump himself, or with his board of advisors, decides that they know what's best to set monetary policy despite what the data says, as they do want to run the economy hotter?
Well, we can look at other countries. What has happened? Look at Turkey. Look at Latin America. Look at it's a terrible, terrible idea because it's a the cost of borrowing goes up. And if you listen to Bloomberg and the like, you hear about bear steepening we've had in the yield curve, meaning that we pull short-term rates down, but long-term rates are moving higher. The cost of the reason why losing independence is such a bad idea, and why. Tariffs have that as a side effect as well, to a small degree, but they do have that impact as well, is because it makes financing deficits more expensive, not less expensive. And the long-term borrowing costs are going up. And so the fix to keeping long-term borrowing costs low is sustainable deficits. That is the fix. And there is just no appetite to do that. And the politically attractive thing is often not the economically sound one, right? And so it's a once you're on that path where deficits are less sustainable, we are focused more on the symptoms rather than the causes. There's always that temptation with politicians, but it's a much, much bigger temptation in the environment that we're in. And we see that a lot of the policy decisions that are being made, and it's not just in the US, it's a symptom of the time that you want to fix. You don't want to fix the fundamentals because that's too difficult. It's difficult to communicate. It's much easier to communicate to punish those who do wrong and abuse whatever, the poor consumer or whatever it may be. But ultimately, you're harming the consumer with some of those decisions.
Axel, this is seemingly a very unprecedented time and situation for many of the markets, many of the pieces that we're talking about here. How do you think about the idea of managing risk within the portfolios, or the portfolio that you manage, in this type of environment?
Well, first of all, we have a precious metals mining fund. And so we have a mandate and we are invested in that space. And it's investors in some ways that choose on how much they want to expose. We can choose where we want to be in that space, whether we want to be more the majors, whether more juniors. We happen to participate a lot in the funding rounds. We want to look for catalysts that go beyond the price of gold to capture more of the upside. On a broader level, I published a book in 2009. Where it's called Sustainable Wealth, and where I kind of try to describe an environment where you have the subtitle is how to live in a world of debt and consumption, and the 200 character or so answer to all of that is you live within your means. right? You because the moment you spend less than you make, everything else becomes secondary because you'll be fine, right? And then part of the reason is like part of the question is why are we investing in the first place? And different people have different objectives, but for the most people, it is something along the lines is, well, I want to have a buffer when I retire, right? I want to have a nest egg. I want to have this or that. So the idea is not necessarily to quote unquote beat the S&P 500 or to necessarily not miss out on the latest meme stock craze. And so it's a question of risk. And there I'm telling people, what risk can you manage? And let me maybe tell you an episode that I have in the past that sometimes talked about sometimes. In the spring of 2009, people talked to me, some brokers came out and said, oh, you've got to double down on stocks and because there's going to be an equity boom. And those were technically right. I still thought that was reckless and irresponsible. And hear me out as to why I argued that is because most people do not rebalance their portfolio on the way up. They don't take chips off the table when things are doing well. And so when you then have a crash, which we had in 2008, almost by definition, those investors lost more than they were comfortable with. It exceeded the risk tolerance that they had. And so in that sort of environment, to double down on the risk portion of your portfolio is just completely reckless. The proper thing to do is, of course, you adjust your risk profile when times are good. You don't get fire insurance when your house is on fire. And so the sort of thing, and it, assuming that we will have more instability with deficits just not coming in under wraps. You've got to figure out how you've got to be work living and working environment that is less stable. Now, let me maybe before I become too negative, there are some positives here as well. We do have a massive push for deregulation. The productivity boom that's been talked about appears to be real and might be increasing. And the way to outgrow your debt is through growth. And so if that works, that there can, we can come out on the other side of that. I'm just kind of with my risk side, seeing that we're not addressing the fiscal issues. And by the way, the Federal Reserve has enabled that with a zero interest rate policy, again, in some way stepping onto fiscal territory, even though only implicitly. And so there are ways to address that. But as far as the risk in anybody's investment is concerned, yes, you have to be aware that that volatile times are ahead and you might want to make sure that you can bear that risk.
You mentioned this idea of companies and especially juniors raising capital in this environment. Are there specific ways that juniors go about raising capital or accessing capital that makes them completely unattractive to you? Or like, are there any, instant red flags in a company that you're looking at?
Well, let me give you two answers. The first one is juniors, of course, raise capital because they need to invest. They tend to get capital for the next phase of their growth, often only a year or two. So the juniors go back to the capital markets. One of the beauties of being in the small producers and that still have a big development section with the high price of gold is that they're generating enough cash that they actually don't have to go back to the markets. And so that's part of the reason why we are quite excited about being in that space. The other part of your question, let me maybe address it this way. The scarcest resource in the mining sector is good management. And in many ways, it's what we think of what we do is venture capital light. And I draw this parallel because I think everybody's aware that in the venture capital industry, what teams get funding? It is teams that have a proven track record. If you have a brilliant idea about the next best thing, you're not going to get any funding if you haven't done it before, or if you the venture capital invest would like you to have a good project, But they really what they need is a great team, right? That is what they look at, and that's what we do. And so the red flag is whether the team is proven, right? What they have done, because it's much more than the price of gold, right? You're dealing with real physical things. You need to have a team that people criticize DEI for all the right reasons, but the one industry that invented DEI well before it was a term is the mining industry. You need to take care of the local community if you want to build a mine. You're not going to be successful if you don't take care of all the stakeholders, right? And say so you want to work with teams that have shown an ability to understand the sensitivities of the local markets, be that in Latin America, Canada, Africa, or Australia, or wherever that might be, right? And so that is the sort of thing that's more important. Beyond that, yes, of course, you want to make sure that the project is sound, right? That is, of course, important as well. But I mentioned those other factors because I think that is at least as important as or if I think actually more important than many of the other factors.
So, Axel, looking, and of course, this is somewhat theoretical here, but looking out forward for, let's say, the next 5 years, and considering what we just saw with Trump, let's say, capturing Maduro of Venezuela here, seemingly the same threat being made towards Greenland and other countries. How do you see that play? Is this a plan to build a larger pool of resources in the Western Hemisphere, or is it to, maybe make sure they don't fall under China's control?
I think the way to look at it is in terms of a changing world order. Most of us are not old enough, well, nobody's old enough to remember the time before World War II, right? We're going back to a 19th century type of governance. A lot of us have grown up in an era, in the post-World War II era, where the US secured global commerce. Not because they wanted to secure global commerce, but because there was a threat, the Soviet Union, NATO was built, and the like. And global commerce was a beneficiary of that trend. When you don't have to be worried about what happens to your ship and the like, global commerce is thriving. I have, long before what happened in Venezuela, argued that what we see in Ukraine and Gaza are just symptoms of a new era. The US is overextended, cannot and does not want to be the global policeman anymore, which means that old factions are coming back out. I mentioned Turkey earlier. Turkey is a powerful country regionally, right? They might want to flex their muscles regionally. And other players may want to do it. If you look at the 19th century, you had local conflicts, including, by the way, a civil war in the US, that maybe you didn't have as many dead as you had during the world wars, but you had regional conflicts. And so what we are seeing now is obviously the US asserting itself regionally in the Northern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere here in the Americas. And the question really is how that is going to play out. And I'm particularly looking at Europe that has just been incapable of building a proper defense industry. Charles de Gaulle used to say that the Rhine is narrower than the Atlantic. And what he argued is that Europe needs to have its own defense. You can't just rely on the US because maybe one day the US is going to turn itself towards Asia or other places. You need to, and there's a wake-up call. Europe will build up its defense, which, of course, historically doesn't end so well either. But they don't even know how to have proper procurement channels, which means they're going to waste a lot of money, which means debt is going to go up. And so, abstractly speaking, it means the cost of doing business is going higher because global shipping routes are less safe. Debt spending will go higher substantially. So, specifically in Venezuela, I think the analysis that I thought was most appropriate is that it was not a question of oil. That's a wonderful narrative to sell it to the audience. It was about national security. The Chinese had a firm foothold. The Russians had a strong presence. There was Iranian drone production apparently happening in Venezuela, and so you don't, when you're the U.S., you don't want that, right? And so you're taking the steps to secure that. The U.S. has a long history of meddling in Latin America. But it is in the U.S. national interest to do that. To address your part of a question, though, is what does it mean going forward? While that national security threat is contained or eliminated, and so the nation building or whatever might happen next is actually very subordinate. And so even if nothing happens down there, the U.S. has achieved its goal. Doesn't mean people won't be outraged because the wrong people are supported or this or that happens, or but from a national security point of view, maybe that's all we get. And by the way, we probably don't want bad news coming out of Venezuela before the midterm election, so don't expect something too radical happening too quickly. But from a national security point of view, that is the most important one. And of course, the same thing with Greenland, with the Arctic melting, there needs to be a strategy to what happens with that. Whether you do that with cooperation or with threats, that's obviously a political decision, and one can argue about the wisdom about how to do that. Clearly, if Greenland were to be taken by force, that would be the end of NATO. But these, if nothing else, what the side effect of these threats mean that Europe is going to take its own defense spending more seriously, and it's high time for them to do it. And I'm not trying to pass a value judgment of should this be done this way or that way. I'm just trying to analyze what it means. And so it means that Europe really needs to think about what it needs to do. And by the way, the part of the reason I haven't even hammered on Europe enough, Europe urgently needs to have this discussion about social spending versus defense spending. Right. One of the reasons why the welfare system is weaker in the US is not just because socially and structurally we're wired differently here, but it's also because we've been spending so much on the military. Europe has kind of outsourced that to the US. And so Europe needs to have a discussion whether they can afford this welfare state when defense spending is more important. And a lot of Europeans still think they can have their cake and eat it. Those times are over. And that message will sink in. But I mean, we're talking as gold investors, and so the positive way to phrase it is those are tailwinds for our investments. The curse of the gold investor is, of course, that when we do well, others often don't do so well. And so what I'm painting here, I don't like what I see, but as an investor in the space, they are quote unquote opportunities.
Well, thinking about those opportunities, Axel, and again, kind of trying to understand the, let's say, the likely path forward, are there any other metals or areas that you're becoming interested in as you think about opportunities, or is it just focused on gold?
Well, we have a mandate to focus on the precious metal side. There are pure plays on gold. On the silver side, one of the challenges of silver is that it tends to be a byproduct. There are very few pure silver mines. There are very few, even fewer, good pure silver mines, and well-run silver mines. Now, when you dig up something in the ground, you tend to get more than one metal. And so, one of the holdings we had, we made a gold investment, they found lithium, right? And so now then the market repriced it as to is to a lithium play. So of course that will happen. A few years ago we thought about maybe launching another precious metals product, and this was before the current boom, and there was interest in strategic minerals but not in precious metals. Now it may have changed because of the run-up we've had. But the one thing maybe I just want to add here, I said earlier, the most important thing is to invest in the best management teams. Those guys are geologists. They like to dig stuff up. They don't really care whether it's gold or something else, right? I mean, obviously some of those guys are gold bugs, but they are really good engineers. And so, and yes, there maybe there are slightly different methods that might be used in different geographies, but they can dig up other things. Now, obviously, if you need to take a metal, you need to maybe refine it or do something else with it. And those capacities are often in China, which is another challenge, right? And so there are real logistical challenges in ramping up commodity production in most commodities, and they all have their unique facets.
Excellent, Axel. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to put a pin in it for today. Obviously, we've gone over many different pieces of, the thesis and where things go from here. Do you have any thoughts as to things that investors should be paying attention to, before we wrap up here?
They should pay attention to the risk in their portfolio, right? That's and when things go up, they can go down. I'm obviously long-term optimistic on this sector, but people do need to remind themselves that it feels a lot better when things go up when they go down, and just do a gut check whether they are comfortable with the volatility they have in their portfolio, and any money you need in the near term, and that might. The definition of that is different for different people. You might not want to have exposed to too much risk. So that's just a broad, general statement.
Absolutely. Axel, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure to get to speak with you. Of course, for anybody that wants to view more of Axel's work, you guys do a monthly chart book that's available at merckinvestments.com and of course on X at Axel Merck. Axel, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.